excluded from a study for something that is medically not going to affect their performance in that study. Are we getting close to the end? Because Connie told me I have 5 minutes, so I gotta, let's roll. Okay, well, this is a much thornier issue, and, you know, we want to raise it because it needs to be raised and because discussion needs to be opened. I don't think that this subcommittee feels that we have made the final decision on this, or nor can this subcommittee really make a decision that has this kind of implications for so many people, but we certainly have talked about it. We certainly have tried to deal with it, at least as a start. One of the issues is, this whole slide is about pregnancy and how to deal with pregnancy in terms of research, and one of the points that we felt needed to be made was that all available data regarding the use of an agent during pregnancy needs to be, once again, not just automatically excluded in sort of a reflex fashion, but really needs to be carefully considered before you say you can't do this. And the point that was raised in our discussions was, for example, pyrimethamine, which is a drug that's used to both treat and now in research studies is being looked at to prevent toxoplasmosis, has in countries like France, where toxoplasmosis is very common, long been used in pregnant women with you know, a reasonable track record of safety. Now, toxoplasmosis is not that prevalent in this country, and our experience with this agent is much more limited. But an important point was made that we consider those kinds of databases, that we consider what the more global experience with an agent has been before we say that you can't be pregnant and be in the pyrimethamine prophylaxis study for toxo. Well, is it reasonable to always exclude pregnant women? And we thought we would, this is what our proposal is, to sort of start the conversation rolling in the larger ACTG arena. We thought a reasonable place to start would be to say that pregnant women should certainly be allowed to enter either, you know, depends on what you want to call, this is again a terminology that shifts, compassionate use or salvage or whatever, protocols for life-threatening illnesses. Most of these we think are probably going to be, at least in our discussion, are probably going to be opportunistic infections. And, you know, unless there's some just clear evidence that this is going to cause great harm, really the issue at hand is getting the woman through the episode alive. And that's, she's not going to make it, the odds of the baby making it are not real fabulous either. And we thought this would be the least controversial place to start as a proposal. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of discussion about this. The point was raised that even in this situation, consent forms would have to really be explicit. Drug companies tend to be very conservative and very risk-aversive about lawsuits, and I think that is maybe a real problem. The point was raised, and I don't at all even pretend to have the answer to this, but I think I'm going to propose it to you as something to think about. Should what people are calling quote-unquote salvage any retroviral studies, which are currently defined as for patients with fewer than 50 CD4 cells, would this qualify as a life-threatening situation? Certainly, ultimately, it's a life-threatening situation, although it doesn't have the immediacy, say, of having a cryptococcal meningitis or pneumocystis pneumonia. And I think that's something that needs wider discussion. As a group, we could not come to closure on this. And as a consideration for whether these antiretroviral studies for women with low CD4 cells, in this particular situation, there was discussion about whether the immune status of the mother, the gestational age of the fetus, that all of these things be sort of considered in the decision making. So those are our recommendations, which we hope to, they already exist in a rough written form, which we want to clean up in written form, add some specific examples, and get them finally approved. They've actually been seen in a preliminary form by the Women's Health Core Committee, and then send this on to the ACTG Executive Committee for our plans are to do just that. Get them, get these recommendations approved. And the next issue is, well, it's nice to have something approved, but how is anything going to get done? And then the next big task is disseminating this information, making sure that people who propose protocols, write protocols, approve protocols, committees that generate protocols, really understand what these recommendations are and take them to heart. So we've got a big sort of publicity task ahead of us once these are approved. Connie asked me if we could just wait. I'm almost finished. Take questions at the end, if you wouldn't mind. The next thing, which it says plans, and we actually did a big piece of this at this morning's working meeting, was to review the primary infection committees. They have a bunch of template protocols, kind of model protocols for different stages of HIV infection, regarding eligibility criteria and endpoints that address HIV disease in women. We talked about this for several hours this morning. I don't think the conversations are finished, so this is an ongoing near-term agenda so that we can give some helpful feedback to the primary infection folks. And my last slide. Well, in addition to all this review of eligibility criteria, as I said in the beginning, one of the other tasks that we really wanted to undertake in the beginning of all of this effort was to figure out what it is that people have tried at different sites, what's worked and what hasn't worked, and, you know, why reinvent the wheel and why not find out what's worked in specific situations and once again disseminate that information to all the ACTUs so that people can learn from other people's experiences. So there'll need to be some use of judgment in that situation because every ACTU and every clinic and every local population they serve is somewhat different, and what hasn't worked in one place might work just fine somewhere else. But we would like to make this information widely available. So to this end, Janie Reese has created a really nice questionnaire which has been distributed to all the study coordinators, and we'll collate their responses and begin to look into it. And as I mentioned before, we will try to solicit similar information from whatever newly awarded ACTUs there are in a couple of months, because everybody in competing anew or recompeting for funding had to fill out, had to create an entire section called Recruitment and Retention of Women and Minorities, so that everybody, at least on paper, had to have some smart ideas, and hopefully we can learn from that too. And once again, then the next issue is disseminating this information, making sure that it gets to where it needs to go. And with that, back to Connie.
Excuse me, I had a question. I just want to know, when were the recommendations going to be going to the executive committee?
I think our plan is to get them the executive committee has periodic meetings and phone calls on a monthly basis. The next one after this meeting is in early January, and our expectation is that we would be able to send them forward at that time. So we will try to get them finalized on paper and sent forward sometime later this month so that they'll have them in time for that next, their next scheduled get-together.
I want, Judy, I'm going to take the prerogative of setting the time constraint so that we're sure that every one of the subcommittees can present, and at the end we'll solicit questions. I regret very much to have to interrupt what will be a productive discussion, but there's time tomorrow and hopefully there will be some time at the end. I'd like to turn to the Gynecology Infection Oncology Endocrinology Committee.
Hopefully I'll be able to get us back on schedule a little bit.
I'm sure I will.
I think one requirement for a subcommittee is to have a long name, but basically we're the gynecology subcommittee of the Women's Health Core Committee, and I'd like to fill you in a little bit on what we've been doing. I don't have any overheads or slides, but we have, I think, made some progress. First of all, I would like to emphasize to everyone who's here that the main process, our charge as a committee, number one, was to ensure collection of gynecologic data in all trials, which I'll address in a few minutes. And we're making progress again toward that goal, so that not only in antiretroviral protocols, but ultimately in every protocol in the ACTU, there will be, or ACTG, there will be a requirement for specific interval G GYN exams with specific requirements to assess things like cervical dysplasia, manilial vaginitis, and also interval forms to collect data on interval episodes for instance, symptomatic vaginal candida. So that was one charge. The second charge, I think, for our group was to ensure that treatment trials for conditions specific to women are included in the ACTG. And I need to remind everyone that the way that's done is through concept sheets. We have now reviewed three concept sheets, which again I'll get to in a moment, but we really need a lot more concept sheets for studies for women. And those are not limited to submission from members of either the subcommittee, the GYN subcommittee, or the Women's Health Core Committee. So all of you that have concerns about things that need to be studied that we have yet has not received concept sheets, please, you know, get working on concept sheets, go back to your centers and encourage people at your centers to start working on things, remembering, of course, that they have to fit in with the ACTG format, which is an AIDS clinical trials group. So there are some natural history studies and things that I think that are very important, but to get those done through the ACTG, they would have to be included as part of some other, either a nested study or part of a treatment trial. And then there are things going on in other mechanisms of funding through the CDC and through other funding sources to look at some of those as well. So anyway, I just want to solicit more studies, more concept sheets, more ideas for studies for women. And again, we need to work within the ACTG framework and realize that there are some limitations to just how broad a study we can do or that kind of thing, but I think we can be very creative in developing studies for conditions that affect women that can fit within the ACTG framework. With all that in mind, I'd like to go on and talk about the three concept sheets which we reviewed yesterday during our subcommittee meeting, let you know what's going on with those and what the timeline is. The first two were actually, one we were the primary reviewer for and one we were actually the secondary reviewer for. They're somewhat similar, so I'll talk about those together, and then I'll talk about the GYN data form at the end. The first study is a randomized trial of 5 fluorouracil cream versus observation for women with cervical dysplasia. Once their dysplasia has been treated, the idea is that at least preliminary data would suggest that there's a high recurrence risk of cervical dysplasia among women who are HIV positive, especially women with low CD4 counts, and that we need to look at offering a sort of a secondary prophylaxis for prevention of recurrence of dysplasia, and this would be a once per month intravaginal 5-FU cream. The concept sheet was reviewed yesterday. There were some comments made which will be written up, and the recommendation of the subcommittee at this point is to go forward with that concept sheet to the core committee and now to the executive committee, hopefully by their January meeting. There was also much discussion about adding a third arm to that study to look at something such as topical alpha interferon or topical isotretinoin or a combination of the two as a third arm to the study. I think that that's something that needs to be explored further, but given the fact that we don't have a commercially available preparation of either of those and the pilot data is somewhat limited, we will continue to explore that option to add a third arm, but at this point we don't want to hold up the progress of this concept sheet and the availability of the 5-FU trial by waiting for that. So we're going to go ahead and we will have that concept sheet to the executive committee for their January review. The second concept sheet, which again we were the secondary reviewers for, was a proposal to look at alpha interferon injection and oral isotretinoin therapy versus observation for, again, prevention of recurrent cervical intraepithelial neoplasia after primary treatment. This was part of a larger trial which was also looking at these therapies for anal intraepithelial neoplasia, and it was decided at this point to split that out, and so the oncology committee will be proceeding with development of the protocol or continuation of the concept sheet for anal intraepithelial neoplasia both for men and women with the condition. But again, it was felt that at this point topical therapies were appropriate for prevention of recurrence of cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, and we'll continue to explore the option of an alpha interferon and or isotretinoin therapy for prophylaxis of cervical intraepithelial neoplasia. So at this point we've sort of let the oncology committee go with the anal and triphthalial neoplasia component of that trial. Finally, the third concept sheet that was reviewed was the GYN data form and the concept sheet that goes with that. The this form has been reworked many times. A lot of you have heard this. And I think, again, as we keep in mind that we're working within the ACTG framework, we've had to be careful to include things that we can justify, things that are important, such as cervical dysplasia, vaginal candidiasis, things like that that are appropriate, again, either entry points or endpoints for studies. And although there are many, many other things that we would like to include on the data collection form, that we have to keep that in mind. The timeline for the GYN data form, again, at this point is that the recommendations made during the review process yesterday will be included in the form. I expect to have the written comments back by the end of next week, and we'll have this revised so that we should have, again, a draft to proceed through the system to the core committee and to the executive committee with the goal to have this concept sheet reviewed at the January executive committee meeting. The next step from there, assuming that it gets approved, which we're working hard to make sure that it is to pilot this form, again, because it is more data collection, more entry. It needs to be field tested to make sure that the questions are clear, that people feel like they can give reasonable answers, and that, you know, we're not getting a bunch of information that's uninterpretable. It will be piloted in Protocol 175, which is the protocol getting ready to start up, at least at 10 sites. We'll make that pilot period as brief as possible. Obviously, it depends on what the accrual for that trial is. Once it's been piloted and we have a reasonable amount of information, we'll go back and make any revisions that need to be done. At the same time, we'll be soliciting site implementation plans from the various ACTUs to figure out how this will be implemented at any given site. And then, again, when the pilot version has been revised, get it out to every ACTU with the plan that this will be included as part of the data collection at enrollment, and then every 6 months for a full exam with pap smear, and with interval collection at least every 3 months at every ACTU site. Again, this is all subject to review and approval by the executive committee, but we are pressing forward with those in aiming to get into the ACTUs as soon as possible. At this point, I think we'll stop and take questions that I'm sure people have. Yes?
In light of getting this protocol that are being developed, what's being now captured, what is being used or recommended for the health committee or your folks to capture that kind of information?
Well, I think that, I mean, it's important, again, for trials where these things are going to be an issue. And again, antiretroviral trials are a big concern. Obviously, a lot of the OI trials are important. We're working on getting information included into those trials at this point. But I think what we have to do is make sure that this is done in a way that we're collecting usable data. And if it's going to have to take a couple of months while we get this piloted and get it on board, I think that if we can take a unified approach, pilot it, and get it out there as fast as possible rather than trying to fragment and have one data form for this protocol and one data form for that, we're going to end up in the same position that Judith's committee is going back to revise now, looking at enrollment criteria and lab criteria and having different criteria for the study. So I think what we're trying to do is to put our energy into getting this unified form for every protocol onto the streets, if you will, as soon as possible, and not fragmenting things. Recommending, though, that people should be collecting appropriate data at this point. I don't think, like I say, that we can go through every single protocol at this point and do this. We need to go ahead and kind of do it in one fell swoop and as soon as possible.
I just wanted to add a comment to that. I've attended the session of Carly Benson in presentation of an emphasis protocol in conjunction at our subcommittee. I'm interested in women and recuperating evaluation.
I think that's a good point. I mean, I think part of our job is sort of consciousness raising within the whole ACTG and all the ACTUs to make sure that this issue is being addressed and the data is being collected. Like I say, though, I'm afraid that in the next few months, if we try to go back and do it protocol by protocol, that we're going to end up you know, fragmenting efforts rather than doing it all at once and collecting the same data from every site.
Well, I was thinking that tomorrow morning there is an executive committee meeting. And as a way of getting it out to everyone who's the chair of some committee at the ACTGs and getting people to start collecting data and not just leave it up to study coordinators, but making it a statement, you know, putting a letter in saying that there should be some data collected right now, I don't see how you could lose on that, you know, to tell people to do that and to inform everyone who's on their trials that that's something that they support.
You said put it on the dash.
Let's get aggressive.
I appreciate everyone's concerns, and I mean, I'm certainly willing to do what we can to get this implemented as quickly as possible, but I'm afraid, again, if we go off and start handing it out, people will get it, you know, people are going to say, oh, we don't know what, you know, we don't have to do this yet, you know, and it's like we need to, the other concern that I have is making sure that women are getting adequate exams and adequate care, and so we want to make sure they're not just, you know, sending them down the street somewhere they don't know or something like that. We want to make sure that there's some quality assurance built into this, because obviously the last thing women want to do is be getting pelvic exams that are not picking up things that they're meant to pick up.
But see, they're not doing anything right now. Something is better than nothing, you know. We're going into 12 years into this epidemic, and these people that are running these trials, you know, don't even acknowledge that we have vaginas. You know, they're still male-orientated. It can't be that way anymore. You have to get aggressive.
Right. We're not arguing that point. I mean, I think that this needs to be done. I guess the issue is getting it done in a way that's going to get accepted at every site and get reasonable data accumulated and getting women the care that they need in a quality fashion. I think at this point we're getting this integrated as fast as we can. I'm not above considering the option of, you know, trying to get on the agenda of the executive committee tomorrow, but I certainly can't make any promises right at this moment that's going to be able to happen.
Heather, can you tell me if you think it's going to take a month to get them out and to have a site check them out, right, and see if you're getting any interpretable data back, then about how long do you think that is? Let's say that's February, so you think that this will be back to you in March, review, and back out into all the ACTG, maybe for the April conference?
That's what we're aiming for. I know I always tend to be a little more optimistic.
That's very conservative.
It's going to take some time for any of these centers to implement the program whereby we can get gynecologists to do a pelvic exam. Why? And I think that one has to be realistic about this. Number one, the forms would have to be certified. This institution has to come up with a plan to be doing those.
I can't do that?
You can demand anything you want. You've got to have the people to do the procedure. You don't have the people to do the pelvic. Demanding it to be back in a month isn't going to solve the issue.
Right.
I think what has to happen is exactly what you said. The form needs to be standardized to make sure that it's clean and that the institutions begin to implement the system if they're going to go to the best interest of the patient's care.
Right. Let me just address two things and then I'll get your question. I think your points are well taken. Number one, I think that there's nothing precluding us from starting to work on the site implementation plans right now. Although, again, this hasn't gone to the executive committee, hasn't been officially approved. There's a lot of sort of interest in this, and I think it's reasonable to get started with that. And there actually has been some legwork being done as far as acquiring site implementation plans. The other thing that I think I need to mention at this point is that we've actually spent a lot of time at several meetings discussing just who would do the exams, and that it's going to be different from site to site, just like the same things that Judith was talking about, and that in some sites that indeed will be a gynecologist, in some sites that may be a women's healthcare specialist or an internist who does what may be considered a screening GYN exam, if you will, with the establishment of good referral networks for colposcopies and workup and then data recovery as far as making sure that things get followed up and get done appropriately. I am a little concerned that if we limit it and say you have to have a gynecologist to do all of this, that we may again be getting back to the same issue of restricting access to care. So you know, I want to make it clear that I think that there's a whole host of people who are capable of doing these exams, and that we want to ensure adequate access of care for all women, and that we need to make sure they have access to colposcopy and biopsy and all the follow-up that needs to be done as well, but not have preconceived notions about who's going to do it at any given site.
I just wanted to say that recompetition is coming up. I don't think that a site should be accepted unless they can show that they can provide adequate care for women. And I agree with you. I don't think it's only a GYN. It could be a nurse practitioner, and it shouldn't be sending a woman to someone that she doesn't know if she's had somebody who's been doing, you know, that she's been relating to in that system. But the fact is that it's not enough to say that at some point. That's why I think it has to be brought up tomorrow, because there is recompetition, and it will. It's not, I mean, I can't believe, first of all, that the large medical centers that are applying for recompetition don't have, you know, people there who can do GYN exams, because they should not be accredited medical institutions, as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, and it seems to me that a lot of the CPCRA sites have people who give primary care, and, you know, this relates back to the whole issue of the accrual of women. You know, if you have primary care, you have women who come back, and women who can be in, besides the kind of entry criteria that have been keeping women out. So it seems to me that tomorrow is a perfect time at an executive committee to put that on the agenda, to make it clear that that has to be part of recompetition, and that it's not acceptable otherwise, because if you end up getting sites that are not going to be able to implement a simple GYN exam, I mean, we make this sound as if doing medicine for women is so much more complicated. It's not, and we shouldn't get trapped into doing that.
I agree with you. Let me just say that I don't think there's any site that isn't capable of integrating this into their program. I think they need a little impetus to do it, which is what we're pushing. And I know some are pushing to have it happen a little faster than others, but we're all pushing for the same thing. So there's no question in my mind that every site can implement this. It may take them a little while to figure out the most efficient way to do it, and so there may be a little bit of time in that, but we're working on getting those site implementation plans. The other thing, which someone can correct me if I'm wrong, is I'm not sure that the executive committee actually, I'm almost sure that they're not the ones who are reviewing the grants and dealing with this issue, in that a lot of the people on the executive committee have actually submitted them themselves, therefore would not be in the review process. So I think the actual review process and looking at a site's ability to accrue women is not within the purview right now of the executive committee. And I don't know if someone wants to clarify that.
That's correct. In a grant review process, for the reasons you mentioned, the grants are not reviewed by the executive. I think everyone is aware the ability to enroll women and a variety of populations is one of the key criteria. And I
who does review them, Constance? If the executive committee doesn't, because of conflict of interest, who does the review?
The reviews for grant applications in any situation are sent to experts who have a conflict of interest.
Within ACTG?
Actually, the full answer to your question, no, not within the ACTG, is beyond probably my purview, and I wouldn't give you information that isn't exactly
some
correct.
White man sits on a hill.
It's given to individuals who have the expertise.
Oh, for God's sake.
The chair, the vice chair, will take every meeting at which opportunities exist to put forth the implementation of the things to occur by the
make them exist.
Should I say that? Mm-hmm. I don't know how long she's been here.
5 years. Since she's been in this ACTG, it's 5 years.
I think, again, we'll have to get the specifics for the site implementation plans together, but I think they could, just as we've done for some of the other trials with site implementation plans, is they can give some options. For instance, for a woman who has pre-existing gynecologic care, that will be provided and they will obtain the records. For women who don't have care, and I would find it hard to believe that any center has all of their women getting gynecologic care already, we wouldn't be doing this. But I think that, you know, I think they need to have several alternatives, and for women who don't presently have gynecologic care available to them, this is how it would be done, whether it's, you know, a gynecologist coming into the ACTU, whether it's a women's healthcare specialist or an internist doing the exam with a clear referral pattern for abnormalities that are detected, you know, whether it's a certain number of guaranteed slots in this gynecologic practice, you know, known to, for women, you know, who are on trials, whatever. And I think, you know, each site needs to be able to develop a plan that they're comfortable with, but they're also comfortable that the women are getting the care that they need and the data is being collected in a reasonable fashion.
I would suggest that it probably would not be a close record from an outside home. So it's a PCP that I know from an outside internist that this person has met the end criteria of the study.
Right.
You're looking at concurrent vaginitis, you want study criteria to be met.
I mean, I think we'll follow the same recommendations that hold for any ACTU trial, which is anything that wasn't done at the ACTU, you need to get the source documentation for. And there again, I think you need to know what lab it was or what the person's capabilities were. But we don't want to get this to be so restrictive that it ends up impeding the very thing that we're trying to accomplish with it. But I think that's a good point.
Take control, comes now. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you very much. And I think it goes without saying that there's a great sense of
urgency.
And urgency on the part of some, and a sense of opportunity on the part of others. But we want to be absolutely sure that, as in all other studies and concept sheets that are put through the ACTG, that it's a quality product, that we've thought out the issues, and that they can be implemented and give good results. So we want to balance urgency and a very high quality and well-reviewed and implemented plan. The next group, is the Epidemiologic Data Review and Opportunistic Infection Committee, chaired by Dr. Howard Lakoff and co-chaired by Dr. Deborah Cotton.
This is going to be a very brief rehash of what most, many of you heard a few hours ago in our subcommittee meeting, and most of that will be presented by David Byrne. Is this on?
It's on.
We have in our subcommittee one long-term objective, which hopefully will be facilitated by the completion of two short-term goals. The long-term objective is to try to use the ACTG to learn about gender-specific response to drugs and something about the natural history of HIV affecting women. In order to design those studies appropriately, we want to do two things. The first is to extract as much usable data as we can from the current data bank, the studies that have already gone on. Number two, to try to get a profile of the women who are available to ACPG sites to enter into these future studies, and work in conjunction with the accrual subcommittee to see what the barriers are to entering women into studies. We're going to have two very brief presentations. Kathy is going to again discuss what we potentially will be able to learn from the data that has already been collected in trials that have been completed and are ongoing. And David will then summarize the instrument we're going to use to try to learn about what sort of patients are currently being seen.
I don't think I'll go up to the overhead because, as many of you were there at our subcommittee meeting, a lot of information. Some of you did receive a couple of handouts, and if you would like to get one, please see me after the meeting and I'll get your name and send out the information that we need. Part of what we did is to look in the database and update an analysis that was done by Deborah Cotton, Judy Feinberg, Diane Finkelstein, and Waylee Hee, looking at women's enrollment into the ACTG trials. And we updated that, and we found that as of September 91, there were 1,071 adult women, trials of 14,372, which is 10.4%. Further, of the 84 studies that were analyzed by that group, studies that were OI, PI, neurology, and oncology studies, there were only 13 studies that had greater than or equal to 10 women, and only 9 of those which had more 20 women or more. So we're looking specifically for in our retrospective analysis at those 9 protocols. And what I did earlier that I won't do now is look at the characteristics, the patient population, the study regimen, stratification factors, and I also briefly describe some of the studies that already have been done and published, one of them a JAMA article by Lagakos et al. Of a month ago that looked at the 016 and 019, the mildly symptomatic and asymptomatic population which were being treated by ZDV, and looked at some of the women's endpoints in those studies. And so that's part of what we've done. Also, we've based upon the review of the database, we have written up a concept sheet looking at several objectives, among them looking at baseline characteristics, stratifying by entry-level CD4.
We would like to be able to survey all the health sites as well, the major ones. But that will be difficult to do.
Are there any further comments? Do you want to solicit dialogue from people about
the numbers within what we on at this
point? We'd be glad to give you a copy. But as you know, some of the sites are only performing studies. Others are also providing primary care. And obviously, we would like to know the same thing about all women being seen at each of the sites. And as I say, also women are actually being enrolled.
One of the issues that we have right now is that we have solicited some comments from people, and particularly from the patient accrual and retention committee, in terms of how to document access, barriers to access to care within the protocol. So also some very good comments made this morning. Actually, one person actually asked if the women were the same one enrolled into other protocols before. The way that the question is asked is actually if they have participated in some antiviral or some of the trials, and not going to be some modifications. We don't know how we're going to implement it. The idea will be that we can get a baseline of in one particular site, whether the woman is enrolled or not in the protocol, what are the discordances in it? Is it the type of protocol that we're putting out that made too much exclusion for the woman not to be enrolled? Or is it actually a referral pattern, and maybe you get more referrals if the clinicians have been informed, like someone suggested in the audience? And the other possibility is that even within one site, there are other issues of social demographic or problems in terms of income, problems in terms of meeting the visits that might be important. So how are we actually going to, the logistic of the implementation is still being worked on.
Me? Yeah, hi. I wanted to suggest that another thing that you could do along with this would be to ask each of those sites to give a questionnaire that someone who is a person who is in one of the trials can mail into you without their name on it, talking about what their experiences have been at that site. That's number one. And number two, for other HIV-positive women who are in that healthcare setting but who have not gotten into a trial but who are being seen, to give them the same questionnaire to mail into you, to ask them things like, has anyone ever told you a protocol? Have you ever gone there? Did you get accepted into it? Because right now you're asking the people who are running the sites to evaluate their sites. I've done that, okay? It's interesting, but it's not necessarily the truth. Okay, and it certainly is not from the client point of view. And if you want to find out why women are being excluded and what their experience has been and why they drop out, for instance, I doubt that a PI is going to tell you that he treated somebody badly or that they waited 19 hours or they didn't get the service. Do you see what I'm saying? So at the same time that you're mailing that out, I think that you can request that those sites hand those out, that they be people be given stamped envelopes to mail them back in with an address on it, that it be an easy form, and that you ask a few basic questions about the care they received, the follow-up, and also for people who are just in that facility but have never been in a trial, have they ever been told about it? Because I know, for instance, that a big issue, NYU has hardly any women, and next door is Bellevue with thousands of women. You know, there's got to be a question as to why you don't get women in that site.
Yeah,
And I think the women can answer it better than the people at the site.
That'll be a good idea. Someone 2 rows behind you is shaking her head.
The reason I'm saying, because this is sort of near and dear to my heart, I mean, this is the whole business of access, is in the eye of the beholder poster. We modified the instrument based on this, which was used on 10,271 inner city adolescents who are predominantly African American to get their knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors pre-intervention, post-intervention, 3 months after intervention, 6 months after intervention. I mean, I got enough debt for pizza parties as intermittent feedback. This is why I'm sort of close to this. And the reason why I'm shaking my head about mailing it back is it's tough. You know, I got to deal with my old man, I got to deal with the rent, I got to deal with the bus. It's a lot easier if people who are in your site that are getting their primary care can do their infant while they wait
for
any site that they immediately get called in and dump it into a box.
Okay.
You never see them. Then when they go for their ACTG, we ask that same population a lot of very basic information. And the people who come back for their ACTG follow-ups give us a grade. Did we get an A up to an F? Not only for your barrier you identified, but just overall, how did we treat you? How do you feel about the nurse? How do you feel about the doc? Do you ever worry about your study med? How much about your study med do you worry about? You get some real useful information, which we had to learn on our site. The nurses were wonderful. The doctors need some help.
Yeah, right.
I hope you can spend a lot of money to get that conclusion. I think there was an intention to have the questionnaire in two parts, or consideration of a face-to-face interview and the self-administered questionnaire. The idea of putting it in the box anonymously is certainly an excellent idea.
081, if I'm not mistaken, was the first protocol to actually do that. I mean, every month you filled out a questionnaire. And some of the questions were good. Some of them were stupid, like, are you an incredible happy person? Oh, I have AIDS, I'm ecstatic, you know? And then, and then that part of it stopped, okay? And the thing about 081, 981, and 181, okay, I think that right there is a very successful trial model, okay? Because basically they set out what they wanted to do. They wanted to prevent PC take, okay? And only like 3 to 8 people or something broke through with PC take. The fluconazole, Michael X arm on that, the women who were randomized fluconazole, and there's a very small number of us. I mean, I know that I am not experiencing chronic vaginitis anymore since I've been on fluconazole, but nobody will look at that. And now 181, which is the proposed natural history study of those two studies, I mean, it's a perfect opportunity to not only reinstate the quality of life questionnaires, but also to do natural history on women who are being treated for like fungal infections, and women who are being treated with TS and which is not only PCP prophylaxis but can be a toxoprophylaxis, and I just think there's things that are right under our noses that people just aren't looking at. And we've been waiting a long time, and we need things to, move there.
I have a question about when anyway reach out to the CBCRA programs, which haven't had to look at what has been outreach and approval and design either on an informal level or...
Not, but again, this is a good idea, and I don't see any reason why we just look at how they survey and see if our approach...
No, they don't have an instrument, but they have a database, an observational database, which, gets some of the demographic criteria that we included in our survey. However, we make some other laboratory parameters because we wanted to monitor some issues on women.
Thank you much. Dr. Rhodes, co-chairs to the committee, and I think that she is not here at the time, and so Mary Jo Sullivan, who is the co-chair, will give an input.
Than I did, so I have to go back on the grid trying to quickly scratch out something that I could remember that we discussed. Now I have to try to be able to read.
monthly, part of the discussion centered around what to call ourselves. That seemed like it should be an issue, but it was. And I think that finally, if I remember correctly, the final decision was the OVP's group. The next issue rotated around the membership of the committee and making sure that the committee had an equal distribution of obstetricians and pediatricians, since obstetrics happens to be an ongoing phenomenon, beginning with prior to conception or preconceptional counseling, through the course of pregnancy, labor, and delivery, and then our product goes to the pediatrician, so that we wanted to have equal representation on both sides. That was finally agreed to, and also agreed to was the fact that we needed to have different types of consultants on the committee who would rotate in and off the committee depending upon what particular issues were going to be discussed. And those consultants would include infectious disease, immunology, both adult and pediatric immunology, and I do think that's important. I said virology, nursing, occasionally it's going to involve laboratory personnel as well, data monitoring people, and so on, would be moving in and out of the committee depending upon the particular issues that were to be discussed at each of those committee meetings. So we were dealing with concept sheets and what those concept sheets involved.